Welcome to Season 4 of the Unscripted Podcast, a podcast by medical students about living and learning at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we host a variety of discussions such as navigating the preclinical and clinical years, exploring humanism in medicine, and developing our physician identities outside of the textbook.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter at unscripted_med. We'd love to hear from you, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. My name is Matthew. On this episode, I'm joined by Rachel and Dr. Brian Elliott. Dr. Elliott is a chief internal medicine resident and captain in the United States Air Force, who is writing a book that will be coming out on January 27th, White Coat Ways. That kind of goes into the history of medical traditions and how sometimes they can interfere with progress in medicine. On today's episode, we're going to chat with Dr. Elliott about some of the traditions surrounding residency in the MATCH and how those traditions can still affect us today. Hope you enjoy. Hello, everybody. My name is Matthew. I am here with Rachel.
Hello.
And our very special guest, Brian. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Excited.
Thank you so much for hopping on the podcast. We're really excited about this one. It should be a great informative episode. We don't get much history lessons in medical school, so I think this will be a nice change of pace. So first of all, I just wanted to start out and say how awesome it is to have written a book during residency called White Coat Ways for everyone out there. Could you tell us a little bit about how that came about and how you had the idea of writing a book?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly didn't start that way. I started noticing all these things in medical school that we were doing, like the white coat ceremony and things like the MATCH, and was like, why? Where did this come from? And why do we continue to do these things? And I looked into it a little bit. I did a lot of research. And then I thought, you know, maybe I'll write an article. And then an article turned into a super long article. And then that turned into, oh, you know, hey, maybe this is a lot more. And maybe there's a book to this. So I broke it down into 7 traditions. And yeah, ended up writing a book. And you say I wrote it during residency, but in a way, it started before, during, and after residency. This has been like a 5-year research project that it has ultimately culminated in a book. So I'm super excited. It'll finally be coming out soon.
Yeah. And could you just let us know, when is it coming out?
January 2023.
It's a great way to start off the new year, right?
Yeah. I'm excited.
It is kind of interesting. I think I feel like medicine, maybe even more so than a lot of careers, is really rooted in traditions. Do you have any like insight to why that is?
Well, part of it is we're an apprenticeship-based practice and historically have always been that way. We learn from the people ahead of us and they like to pass things down. Some of those things are great. Some of those things are medical aspects that we should learn, but some of those things just kind of slip through. And we definitely have traditions that have slipped through for centuries and even longer now. And they need to be evaluated just like those medical aspects too.
It reminds me of the journal, the scholarly works that are things we do for no reason. Those articles that, you know, people write up about, you know, things we do on the wards or on rounds that really have no purpose, but they've just been there for years and years and years. And our preceptors did them and their preceptors did them, and but they really have no utility in the way that we practice medicine now. So that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. They always look at scientific things, you know, screenings that may not necessarily be worth doing, or CT scans or whatever, but all the things that we do with our patients, including the traditions, should also be thought of that way. Mm-hmm. So that was the impetus for this book. And they're not all anti-tradition. Some of them I actually argue for the tradition, or at least I present the history and show how there is merit to some of these. But a lot of them, not so much.
And I will say it's definitely hard as a medical trainee to tease out sometimes like what are traditions and what are things that should be followed as fact. Like, for example, I'll work with an attending that just has a certain way of doing things because that's how it's always been done versus an attending that is doing things, you know, evidence-based that is because all the research that's come out throughout the past years. And not saying that that's a black and white thing, because I think every attending probably has some practices that are tradition-based and some practices, and hopefully a lot of practices that are data-based, but it's definitely hard to tease out at least my level, what is tradition-based and what is data-driven.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be afraid to ask. I mean, certainly do it in a way where you're looking for the educational aspect of it. When I work with residents and students, I try and say, oh, I chose this dose of Lasix because there was a trial that showed it to be beneficial, or I chose this dose of Lasix because that's how I'm feeling today. And I think that it'll work well. And that's not based on any solid evidence. So that way they at least know, you know, okay, the 80 milligrams that I said was a reasonable choice. It's just not his choice.
Mm-hmm. I think tying into that, you could probably call it a tradition, but at this point, I don't know if it's best regarded that way. The aspect of residency, it started a long, long time ago, way back in the early 1800s, and it's something that still persists today. And that's going to be really the main topic that we cover today is the history of residency and the history of the match. And those are two big things I know are burning in your mind right now, Rachel. So I'm excited to hear how they all started and kind of what it means for us today. We can go ahead and kick this off. I think one of the most important questions to know before we talk about the history of residency and the match is the aspect of medicine as a calling. And I think this is something that I would say most, I know I thought of medicine as a calling and I still do think of medicine as a calling, but in your book, you touched on this a little bit of where this all started and how this viewpoint still impacts us today. So can you talk a little bit about this idea of medicine as a calling?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is, you know, for anyone who's in the medical field to kind of ask yourself, is medicine something that I do, or is it who I am? And there's certainly good and bad aspects to the latter. There's good, you know, being passionate about your work, loving what you do, but there's also asking too much of yourself. And that's some of the negative aspects that can come from it. And we were actually talking a lot about this on Twitter recently, but it's something that you should ask yourself because you're going to be the one who has to draw that line in the sand of how much of your life that medicine takes over. But like you said, it wasn't always that way. I mean, certainly the tradition now and some of the expectations from some providers is that you do give all of yourself to medicine. And it didn't used to be that way back in the 1800s, 1700s, when medicine first started to become professionalized. It was really more of a part-time job. People used to be carpenter physicians. There was one guy who used to rob stagecoaches and also be a doctor at the same
it's
time.
A fun job.
I don't know how. Yeah, I don't know how you have the ethical standards to do both at the same time, but that's what he did. But it certainly wasn't, you know, I'm a doctor and that's all I do, partly because you couldn't pay the bills that way. It didn't pay nearly what it did now. And also because it wasn't really recognized as a solo profession at the time. And like you said, that didn't come along until residency. Residency was really the turning point when medicine started to be all encompassing.
Gotcha. That's interesting to me because, man, I'm forgetting my like ancient Greek history, Roman history, maybe, but wasn't like Hippocrates the first physician way back in, is that Hippocrates? Sorry.
Clearly what oath do we take at the beginning of med school?
Right. So he was what I remember as the first physician thousands and thousands of years ago. How did it take so long for physicians to become recognized as like a way of living?
Well, I think part of the problem is you've been lied to a lot about Hippocrates and what he is and what he did.
Especially about how to pronounce his name.
So a lot of that may stem from that because back then, a lot of the healers were religious professionals too. Even Hippocrates, whose big shtick was saying these things are not some ghost or spirit or other thing in your body. There is something natural to it that we can observe and then diagnose or come up with a name with or some prognosis from it. But in a lot of aspects, there were still religious professionals just because that's what the time was. Everyone believed in pretty much similar religions. So they used that as well.
So kind of the way I understand it, it's like it didn't become more evidence-based until starting in like the 1700s, 1800s, like a move away from religion towards science started to begin at that time. Is that right?
I would say that's still the pre-scientific era. So it didn't necessarily transition from religion to science at that point. It transitioned to a job, something that you could do to pay the bills and keep a roof over your head. Before that, you know, in the 1600s, a lot of it was actually women in the home who took care of people. And there were not really hospitals that, you know, there were a couple of secular institutions in the 1500s, 1600s, especially when King Henry created a transition. But a lot of the outside the home care was through religious providers. And then in the 1700s, it started to become professionalized. There started to be physicians that you would seek out for medical care, both in and out of the home. And then the scientific era, that came around 1900, and that came synchronously with the residency transition. And residency partly came about because of the scientific revolution.
Okay.
We finally had evidence. And because of that evidence, they had to make sure that providers knew it and were using it effectively.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something that I didn't necessarily understand about. I think it was it King George that did something in medicine? Could you elaborate on that?
King Henry.
Henry.
So, like I said, a lot of institutions, a lot of hospitals used to be religious institutions. Mm-hmm. They were just paid for by the state, and they would take care of sick people, especially poor people who couldn't afford anyone to come help out in the home. And King Henry, long story short, basically disagreed with some of the religions at the time. So he started creating an institution that was not religious, more so a hospital. So he's partly credited with coming up with the first secular hospitals that weren't religious based. He also had multiple wives and was not a nice person. So this was an incidental creation.
This is important context.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I feel like you think of doctor as one of those jobs that has always existed the way it has for however long human history has been around. So it is really interesting to me to hear that it hasn't always looked the way we expected it to. And even when it started to get more professionalized, it sounds like in the 1700s, it still does not look or did not look similar to the way it does now. Could you talk about a little bit how it started to get more professional and what that looked like?
Yeah. So a lot of men basically came about and earned wages from taking care of people. And that rose throughout the late 1700s, early 1800s. But the type of physicians that they were varied drastically. I mean, you had a lot of different sects of medicine. There was the traditional allopathic physicians that we talk about that came about in the 1800s. But there were a ton more. There was Thompsonianism, which was a type of physician based off of one guy, Thompson, who basically wanted to make a ton of money. So he patented a treatment and sold it in the 1830s. And it was very successful. But it was by no means medicine. There were homeopaths, which a lot more people recognize today, homeopaths being people who feel that like cures like. So if you had diarrhea, for example, they would give you something that causes diarrhea because they felt that something like cures like. But that was their whole thing. And all of this medicine in that era was kind of more ideologic than it was scientific, like we have today. Today we have scientific medicine, which is a method, right? We search for the truth through the scientific method, and that's how we know what's evidence-based. But back then, it was just some guy who was charismatic and talked well and could convince you to buy his patented treatments, and they created these really cult-like institutions of medical practice, and that was a huge uptick in professionalized medicine.
Kind of sounds like They're like door-to-door salesmen almost.
Yeah, yeah. And don't get me wrong. I mean, the traditional doctors at the time too were also pretty bad at their jobs. I mean, they were bloodletting. They were doing a lot of things that we obviously don't do anymore. So no one was really good at medicine back then. It wasn't until the late 1800s that some of the premier physicians, like you may have heard of Osler and some of the other ones, they started to come about and have useful methods.
So pre the professionalism of medicine, and you know, these people who were selling their products and bloodletting and you know, doing all of these different forms of medicine, how did they become trained or qualified to practice medicine? Was there any sort of system?
Good question. So no, not really. A lot of it was apprenticeship based. Some of it was, you know, like Thompson didn't really have any. He just came up with this thing and then sold it very well. There was no accreditation. There were minimal to no licensing requirements to practice medicine. It was the Wild West of medicine. And that's why the type of doctor that you had varied so much, because there were no standards. Medical school at the time was maybe months to years. The medical schools really just want to make a ton of money. In many of the private institutions that were not university-based. So they made medical school really short and really easy. So they were not very good doctors. And it was really this lack of rigor and lack of uniform standards that made it such a wild west.
Sounds very dangerous.
Yes.
I'm like, I can't even think about that. Which is why
they came up with residency.
About what time period did that first come about?
So in the United States, it was the end of the 1800s. So a guy by the name of John Hopkins died, and he bequeathed a ton of money to create not just a medical school, but the premier medical institution. So a man by the name of Dan Gilman was in charge of creating this institution, and he sought out the best of the best. One of which was Osler, who many people know for quotes that may or may not actually have been things that he said. And they went to this hotel, and Dan Gilman showed him Osler the hotel. And he said, you know, everything's very organized here. We have department heads. We have people under the department heads who are middle management, semi-trained. And then we have the workers, you know, maids, clerks, everyone who's carrying out the day-to-day stuff. And they said, this is what we want a medical institution to look like. And Osler, who had done some time in Europe, where they have doctors who do extended apprenticeships and hang around under the tutelage of some of their premier providers, said, those will be our middle managers. So William Osler, William Welch, William Halstead, and Howard Kelly, I assume they couldn't find a fourth person with the name William. they created this program at Johns Hopkins, and it was the first residency program. And that's mostly what they're famous for, especially Osler. Halstead is famous for that and his fierce addiction to cocaine.
I will refrain from commenting on that one. But how does the creation of this residency program kind of shift the mindset of, you know, medicine as a profession versus as a calling?
A lot of that is shown in the way that the residency was structured. So if you wanted to be one of the first residents under Osler, you made no money. You got to live in the hospital, which is why they're called residents, by the way. It wasn't outlawed to be married, but it was very much frowned upon. And all you did was work there. So it was like being in a monastery. This is what you did. It was who you were. And that was the expectation.
Wow.
The interesting part about it is, you know, reading some of LaFleur, who was the first resident, and his time there, they loved it. They actually had a fantastic time. They were like, this is, you know, we're trailblazing. This is uncharted territories that we get to explore with the best physicians in the world. And they didn't record any negative thoughts really about this.
this might be asking you to like read minds of people hundreds of years ago, but just thinking about it, like you said, of course, they enjoyed being on the trailblazing side of medicine. Do you think there is anything else that went into the like lack of negativity that they experienced? Because to me, like, I love medicine. Like, this is what I want to do for sure. But if I had nothing else outside of it, I think I might be driven crazy.
Yeah, I think part of it's founder's bias. I mean, these were people who sought the positions. These were just a few people in the entire country who came to specifically study under Halsted and Osler and all these premier physicians that are of historic caliber. So part of it is, you know, it was just a few people. And part of it is, it really was a trailblazing time. They felt that what they were doing was historic, and it was. There is also a lot of differences between what hospital care was like back then compared to what it is now. Hospitals are way busier than they were back then. There are way more medical facts that people need to learn, and residency is structured very differently. So it's not an exact comparison, and certainly they had a lot of morale together too, and that played into it as well.
What you just said made me think of, I hadn't even considered this before, but the specialization of medicine and how we have all these specialties now because we know so much information, we have so much data. But I'm sure back then when they created this residency, there were no specialties and they were just practicing medicine, which probably included surgery as well.
Well, those were a little bit different, but it was basically medicine and surgery.
Okay.
And then there were a few niche things, like William Welch was a pathologist, Howard Kelly was more like an OB-GYN. Mm. And there were some branch points, but it was nothing like what we have now. I mean, nowadays people don't just specialize in oncology, they specialize in this type of cancer, and they are like the expert in this type of cancer. And certainly that varies from region to region, but like you said, there was specialization back then was nothing compared to what it is now.
Mm.
Being like the progenitor of the modern day resident back then, could you talk a little bit about the level of responsibility and what their job looked like then and how that sort of began to evolve throughout the late 19th century into the 20th century?
So in Osler's original residency, they were middle managers. I mean, that was their vision, that these people would help guide some of the early trainees in what they were doing. As you start to move through the 1900s, this residency program began to expand. Hospitals were like, oh yeah, we want that. We want people to hang around and be paid nothing or little to nothing and work for our hospitals. They did eventually have to pay people because not everyone in the country was willing to work for free. And residency wasn't mandatory at the time, so they had to incentivize some people to come. But as more and more hospitals across the country started to recruit people, and as intern year at least became mandatory across the country, the work certainly transitioned. In a lot of instances throughout the mid-1900s, people talk about, you know, the interns are just there to do all the scut work. They're drawing labs, but not taking an actual part in the care of the patient. And some of that did dwindle a little bit with the expansion.
So, you know, it sounds like as you're talking about these primitive residency programs and how they expanded, it sounds more like people were applying for jobs and they were undergoing this training at the hospital. They were getting paid. It's very different than how we know it now and what I'm currently going through with the match. But, you know, at what point and how did things kind of lead up to the development of a match?
Yeah, so in that, you know, 1900 to 1950 transition point, what happened was they wanted to cut out all those low-level providers, the ones who were not practicing scientifically based medicine. And to do that, they started making intern year mandatory starting in 1911, and they started having licensure requirements. So you had to have a medical license to practice. And part of that was, you know, you had to do a legitimate medical school, and then you had to do intern year, and then you could practice medicine. And as that went from state to state to state and across the country, the at least some component of residency became mandatory for everyone, the amount of people looking for spots went up, and the amount of hospitals looking for new residents shot way up. So hospitals really became desperate to get residents and interns to work in their hospital, and they started doing a lot of things to recruit people. And what they found was this was not beneficial for the medical students who were trying to look for residency positions. In fact, it was terrible for them. Hospitals would basically call up a med student second year of med school, say, hey, we can offer you a spot when you graduate, but you have to let us know in the next 24 hours. And if you're a second year medical student, you're going to be really freaked out and stressed about that. So it became terrible for medical students in trying to look into what they were going to do after graduation. So that was a lot of the impetus that drove big change in terms of recruiting for residency.
Wow. So basically it was like when you're in high school and you're trying to figure out what college to go to, it's like getting calls from all these different colleges of like, hey, you should come play for us. Hey, you should come play for us. Except in the medical field with hospitals, and they give you a 1 day notice of what to do.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great analogy, but just like them, they need a governing body, the NCAA, which of course has downsides, just like our governing bodies, but they needed that governing body to centralize it and create restrictions. So you can't recruit for college in middle school, which is kind of what they were doing to the medical students back then. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions in terms of the match and residency is that this whole process was created to help medical students. It was because they were being treated poorly. So our governing body decided to step in and create this system to help them out.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of med students these days are frustrated with the match and with, you know, a lot of aspects of the medical education system in general, but a lot of it feels like it's out of your control. And I think people get frustrated by that. And so it's nice to have this perspective that, you know, prior to the match, things actually weren't so great and it was created for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a lot of debate on this online, and I love getting involved in the debate on what our system would look like now without a match system, because it's interesting. It's a very different landscape in terms of how many potential residents there are, how many hospitals and residency programs are looking for applicants. But I am skeptical that getting rid of this system that was created to help them would actually be better.
I think it's just thinking about this. It's interesting too that, so what year exactly or decade was the match introduced then?
So I believe it was 1952 that the match first started.
Okay.
And it continued to evolve over time. It wasn't a one and done, but they created it in the 1950s and it started working out pretty well. And then they started tinkering with it and trying to figure out which algorithm best worked. So they consulted some economists and they looked into it, created this algorithm that actually was designed to do a little bit more benefit to the medical students applying than the institution. So they get a little bit of an advantage in the algorithm. The issue is they have to create an algorithm that helps the individual, but also helps everyone and optimizes the overall match to the system. So it is a super complex issue. And their solution was so groundbreaking that it later won a Nobel Prize in economics in the 1990s.
The match won a Nobel Prize?
The algorithm that does the match won a Nobel Prize. Or wow. I should say the person who created the algorithm won the Nobel Prize.
Right. That, yeah.
That's so interesting to think about. I know there's plenty of things that are introduced in the 1950s that still stick around today, but you know, the world has, I think, changed so much. And one of the biggest changes is like the internet and the information age and how much less local everything feels. At the time the match was introduced in the 1950s, I would say most people probably, and this is going off nothing, but probably were born and died in the same city. And nowadays we're traveling all over the country for medical school, for jobs, for whatever. Everything just feels so much more global. Do you think the principles of the match and what it was founded upon still hold true today?
That's a tough question to answer, because a little bit of that would be having a crystal ball and seeing what life would be like without a match. I don't think that we would necessarily go back to the what they called the exploding offer system, where these medical school or these residency programs just called up medical students first and second year and said, hey, come to us. But it would be different. The issue is that there's always more applicants to residency than there are spots. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it puts the ball in the residency program's court. So they have a little bit of an upper hand. And looking at all the history of it, I'm skeptical that they would do what's in the best interest for medical students with that upper hand. So I think the principle that we need a centrally governing body to facilitate this pairing of medical students with residency programs, make sure that there's no mistreatment or early recruiting or, you know, other steps that would be deleterious to the medical students, I think that principle stands.
And maybe this is just a misunderstanding on my part, but why do you think it is specifically for the medical field that this issue of such early recruiting occurred with residency in medical school? And why was that not a thing seen for other jobs, or maybe other apprenticeships would be a better comparison?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack with that. I kind of compare it to the NBA. If you are an NBA team, it's structured so you somewhat have a monopoly, right? There's the NBA. There's the one organization who has all these multiple programs that are looking for the best of the best. And then you have an influx each year of applicants who get tiered, and you want to recruit the best applicants to their program. So medicine is very hierarchical, and we want the best of the best. So that pushes programs to be more aggressive in their tactics. And, you know, other professions aren't quite as hierarchical and stratifying as we are. So that's part of it. Another part is just the numbers game. There's only so many medical students graduating. There's only so many residency programs. And both of those numbers are actually very tightly controlled. So the number of residency spots is dictated by laws that were passed in the 1990s through some Medicare billing. So all of those other control aspects make it difficult for it to be a free market style interplay.
You bring up a really good point about, you know, the number of residency applicants and the number of spots. And I believe, I'm not like completely up to date with this discussion, but I believe that, you know, some people are pushing for the government to fund more residency positions and just to really invest in residency training. Am I correct in saying that? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a tough one to answer. Yeah, certainly there's a push that they should fund more spots. And everyone always talks about this. I mean, there is a shortage of physicians. And in theory, if we create more residency spots, then that will be better. The history of that is that this was premeditated. We actually, as medicine, the institution of medicine, we actually wanted that limitation on providers. So comparing this back to the 17, 1800s, there were so many providers. So they worked it part-time because they didn't make any money and there weren't rigorous standards. Whereas now we have set a cap on that. And like I said, when they made that bill in the 1990s to limit the number of residency spots, that was based off projections that there were going to be too many physicians. Mm. So they did that intentionally to limit the amount that we would have today to A, make sure that they were the best of the best, mm-hmm. and B, ensure that the profession could still provide a pay that could pay off all these loans that you guys are all too familiar with right now, probably.
Mm-hmm. Just so I'm getting this straight. So this bill in the 90s, this is the one.
There was one in the 1960s that decided to pay residents and this is how much they'd make. And then in the 1990s, that's when they set a new cap on the amount of residency positions. They essentially capped the supply is in your supply and demand. The demand is always going to be high for medical care. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of how it works, especially in the United States. But they did intentionally put a cap on the supply of physicians that would be available. Now, and this is getting out of my area of expertise, this is more of like a public health conversation of where and when there are supply demand lopsides. Mm-hmm. So it's historically and continues to be rural areas, the underserved populations that are really the ones who suffer for this. Mm-hmm. So part of it is a limitation of physicians. And some people say that if we did make more residency spots, there would be a filling in of this gap. But a part of it is also just moving physicians to those areas where they are underserved.
So I'm interested, you've been hinting at all of these different, pieces of legislation that have been passed over the past, say, 70 years or so. Could you just kind of take a step back and give us a brief timeline of these important pieces of legislation that have been passed?
So I'll start with residency. So the very end of the 1800s, early 1900s, residency was started. Osler created his vision of having these trainees stay on for extended apprenticeships, and they live this, you know, monastery-like lifestyle. And then that spread from institution to institution. And in the 1910s, that's when states started saying, okay, you have to do an intern year. You have to do some residency to be a practicing physician. And that really drove up the residency spots throughout the country. And that went state by state through the decades. And then 1950s, that's when the magic came around, because the growth was so fast and the mistreatment of medical students prompted them to step in and make that change. And then there was a discrepancy in pay, right? Because if you were going to work with physicians like Osler and people who were premier physicians in the United States, they could probably get you for not paying you at all. Whereas some of the other institutions that really needed people had to pay a lot more. So in the 1960s, with Medicare and some other bills, they passed that we're going to pay resident physicians this much. So a lot of people don't realize that residency salary is mostly driven by government payments. I mean, that's who pays for residency salaries, with some extenuating circumstances. And then things kept going. You know, the salary really hasn't changed that much other than just for inflation. And then in the 1990s, they were projecting that they were going to have too many physicians. They were worried about that. So then they passed legislation to cap the number of residency spots. And then they sued the Met in 2002. And they tried to topple this whole system.
And how did that go?
Well, why don't I start with the background? So 2002, poetically at the place where they founded a residency, a research fellow and a few residents said, this is a monopoly. The match facilitates a monopoly, and we don't get to negotiate our wages and do all the other free market things that people typically get to do for their job once they graduate. So in 2002, they sued the match and every institution that helps with the match. So the AAMC, the AMA, the American Hospital Association, and a bunch of other institutions. And these are multi-million dollar institutions. So they felt that they could potentially secure a $9 billion settlement from this lawsuit against the match. And lawyers were obviously very excited for that kind of payout. And it went terribly, to answer your question. It turns out when you sue a bunch of multi-million dollar institutions, they win. So what ended up happening was these institutions didn't even take it to court. They lobbied Congress, who in a law that has nothing to do with medicine, I think it's like a pension fund law or something, they have a small section where it says sustainment of antitrust practices in graduate medical education in the United States. And that secured the legality of the match and the way that our system operates today.
I think it's...
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how much the courtroom decided our system.
Right. I feel like it's a lot more complicated than I realized at first, because it's kind of hard for me to tease out what is protecting us and what is hurting us. Like, for example, there's a lot of talk about residency wage, but is having it capped helping us or is it hurting us? Like, for example, I'm sure if there was no legislation brought about, then maybe a resident at Johns Hopkins would be paid way less than a resident that's out in, you know, the middle of North Dakota. And then same thing for capping the number of residents, like that just generally is probably keeping attending salaries to the level that we can pay for our loans.
Yeah. And you should feel confused. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It wasn't like a premeditated plan of this is how this is going to work out. To be honest, no one really knows. No one really knows what it would look like without the match. I'm certainly in the school of thought that there would be disadvantages that would come about for medical students. But that is the big counterpoint, is how would it potentially help resident wages? You know, I don't want to go too far out of the scope here, but there are certainly other ways to help residents negotiate. Like I said, resident salaries are mostly driven by government wages. So there are ways to facilitate, you know, hospitals that are benefiting from this labor to get involved and increase some salaries. But like you said, I do worry about discrepancies between institutions that are renowned paying residents very little because they know they can attract them, whereas other institutions, especially those in the rural and underserved communities who may not have the means to even pay those higher salaries that they would need to attract residents, I worry about them and their ability to get residents to come.
I think the more and more I hear about this, the more and more it emphasizes kind of what we were talking about in the beginning of how tradition-based medicine is. Can you talk a little bit about medicine as a calling, how it compared to then, and what are your thoughts on calling medicine a calling now?
Yeah, so I would say the other big thing we haven't gotten into yet is the big damage of calling it a calling, the big damage of being that resident and literally living in the hospital and working there all the time. And that was best shown with the case that toppled residency work hours and their limitations. And sorry, I'm bringing up another court case. This happens. It's just how things are made. So in the 1980s, because we talked about all the financial stuff, this is the work hour restriction that everyone talks about, mm-hmm. that 80-hour work week. That was the 1980s. And it came about with a case called the Libby Zion case. So she was an 18-year-old girl who had a flu-like illness, wasn't feeling too well, had a history of depression, took some phenylzine at home, but for the most part was a healthy 18-year-old doing healthy 18-year-old things, going to college, living her life. And she presented to the hospital. She had a fever, some flu-like symptoms, but nothing major. They admitted her for just some fluids and observation, and the residents took care of her. And overnight, they continued to take care of her along with the other 40 to 60 patients that they were looking after because they were the on-call resident and intern. And then throughout the night, she became agitated. They restrained her both chemically and physically. So they put her in a jacket and gave her medications for some restraint. And then she popped a fever to 107. They tried to cool her down and couldn't. She died. And then they called her dad, who was Sydney Zion, who was not just any normal dad. He was friends with the district attorney. He was a huge media presence. He wrote for like the New York Times and had a bunch of connections. And he said, they did it. They killed my daughter by giving her these medications. She was, by the way, theorized to have serotonin syndrome in this, you know, post hoc look at what happened. But he tried to not only sue them, but criminally charged them with killing his daughter. So he did not get that to go through. They threw out the criminal charges, but they didn't win some of the lawsuit. And part of what that caused was something called the Bell Commission. And the Bell Commission came around and said, this is unsafe. You know, part of the reason that this may have happened was because of extended work hours and they're looking after too many patients. So they said residents can't work more than 24 hours and they can't work more than 80-hour weeks. And that was a huge landmark trial. And, you know, people, as they do when traditions get changed, freaked out. They're like, you know, how are we going to train doctors if they can't work more than 8-hour work weeks? But going back to your point about traditions in medicine and medicine as a calling, I think that's part of the issue, right? I think it's fine to think of medicine as a calling if you say that you're passionate about what you do, you love what you do, and you like learning. And just like the people who were in Osler's first residency, you love blazing new paths and discovering new things and working at the hospital. But the downside is, if medicine is all that you do, you're forgetting that you're a human being and you have needs that are outside of medicine. And that's more this latter case of human beings can't stay up for 72 hours straight and they can't work insane work hours because they have to be human beings.
That's definitely impactful. And I think it rings true for a lot of healthcare workers, not even just residents, physicians today. I feel like there is a bit of a work-life balance crisis at times that can even spill over into mental health crises. And, you know, it's hard to manage how often or how much you work, but can manage what you do outside of it and making sure that, you know, have other things that you look forward to after work or other things going on in your life that you can dedicate time towards. I'm curious though, do you think that, you know, this, first of all, I'm curious where they got the 80 hours as well as, you know, the 24 hours and at one time where they got that criteria.
It was totally made up.
Okay. So no data driven anything.
And that's the beautiful thing about history is you get to see where somebody was just like, 80 sounds good. We'll just pick 80. And there's been a lot of data since then. People have certainly looked at this. There was actually a really good article in the New England Journal recently of resident burnout and how many hours they work each week. And you just see it be a direct correlation and it goes up over time with how many hours that you work. But at the time, they just kind of picked it.
Okay. Could you see legislation changing that? I feel like from talking with you that the match, like it or not, is probably here to stay more or less how it is for the foreseeable future. But is there more wiggle room with this burnout and the hours limit that we have on residents?
I think they don't need to change it because it's already being broken. And there's data on this too. They've certainly interviewed residents. How often are you breaking work hour restrictions? Mm-hmm. And how often are your superiors pressuring you to break work hour restrictions? And it is too frequent. So I don't even think they would need to go to legislation to change this sort of thing. I think that there's this culture expectation that ties into this thought that medicine is who we are, that pressures people into staying up way past them when they should stay up. I once had a surgeon tell me how proud he was of the story where he stayed up 3 days straight and was taking care of patients. And that's just horrifying. I mean, think of your surgeon operating on you who hasn't slept for 48, 72 hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't need data on that.
And I guess just thinking about this to myself, really that change then has to come from us as we start to move up, you know, changing the outlook on what is needed to be a resident and what is expected, and that we shouldn't put our residents through things just because we did it. And once again, it seems to be this sticking piece of traditions that persist sometimes unnecessarily through medicine that bring about a lot of these issues.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a cultural change, and because it's cultural, it's on all of us.
There's only so much that you can do when it comes to, you know, working more or less than 80 hours a week. Like when it comes down to it, if you're expected to stay longer because someone's coding, or if, you know, crap hits the fan and you have to stay longer, then that's one thing. But something that I've noticed going through residency applications now is that there are other ways to circumvent this issue. So, you know, I'm applying med peds, and this is, you know, one specialty out of many, but I am seeing a shift from Q4-day 24-hour calls to not having call at all to having night float instead. And, you know, I'm sure that there's this whole discussion with that, but smaller changes like that also help with wellness and having a little bit more of a balance and kind of feeling more energized and capable when you're at work.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm a fan of the night float system. My residency program has a night float system. I did, you know, surgical ICU, which had 24-hour call, which, you know, it was fine, but I certainly prefer the night float system. Mm-hmm. But you also don't want to go too far the other end. And there's also a lot of research in the area of each handoff is a potential place for there to be medical errors. So there's a balance here. And of course, physicians do probably have to work long hours. That is part of what it is, but it doesn't need to be 120 hours. And one of my favorite studies that looked at this sort of thing looked at, you know, are they breaking work hours? And okay, are they breaking work hours because they're doing it for the benefit of a patient or because they're feeling pressured by their superiors? And, you know, I'm fine with them doing it for the benefit of a patient, especially if it's on their own volition. It's the cultural expectation to me that is really that's the damaging piece.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel like some people think it's a badge of honor to stay late way past when they need to. And that's the thing that's not necessary.
Yeah, it's kind of perceived as an example of like grit or ability to kind of push themselves into the ground and push themselves further than other people. But in reality, it can cause a lot of issues and it can be very dangerous to patients.
Yeah, totally agree.
So Dr. Elliott, golden question. What do you think that we can do to combat this burnout and all of these issues with work-life balance and everything like that?
Definitely remember, as you go up in the hierarchy of medicine, what it would be like at the previous stage. Remember what it's be like a medical student. Remember what it's be like to be a resident. And know that it's tough at times. And if you see somebody who's struggling, reach out and try to help them and give them resources. And like I'm saying, we got to stop this cultural expectation of working for the sake of working.
Yeah.
But slightly unintentionally, we kind of created a somber atmosphere with the number of hours and pay and everything. But I think a good thing to keep in mind is looking back 70 years ago, we wouldn't even be able, or 80 years ago, we wouldn't be able to imagine what those residents were going through. And hopefully 80 years from now, or even less than that, people will look back and not even imagine what our predecessors and what we go through. So I think that, again, is a good sticking point, is that, sure, there's a lot of issues right now with the current system, but you know what? It's something that we're continually improving. And the fact that we're even having conversations about it is the important thing to changing the issues that we currently have.
Yeah, definitely. And sorry for the somber atmosphere. It's part of the topic, but you know, and just like handoffs, we don't want to go too far the other way. Medicine was terrible. You know, the providers were not good at what they did in the 1800s because there was no rigor. So it's good that we have licensing requirements. It's good that we have rigor in our residency program. And, you know, that's why residency was created, to make good doctors. And we should always keep that in mind. But we shouldn't forget that, and this is true, doctors are human beings and they have needs. And Freudenberger, who is one of the, you know, he was the guy who coined the term burnout, you know, said it best. It's doctors are particularly susceptible to this because we care, because we want to do right for our patients. We want to excel in what we do, but we're also trying to balance that with our own personal needs. And it's when people forget that last part that we still shouldn't neglect our personal needs that we really get into trouble.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Brian, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate everything that you taught us today. And I thought I would learn what's the right answer and what's the wrong answer about residency and the match, but I appreciate more learning about how complex of an issue it is and that it is food for thought more so than anything about how many things are at play and can be affected if we change things. So these are all certainly conversations that we'll continue to have. And I'm sure as a result of this podcast, it'll have a lot of impact on what people think about it.
I'm getting the sense that I've taught you plenty to help contextualize medical society and how we got here. And now you're more confused and questioning reality. And
absolutely.
I think that means I've done my job. I think that means I did it well.
That's
I taught you, but now you're more confused.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you once again. And for everyone listening, don't forget White Coat Way is coming out January 23. I know I'm going to get a copy because that's just one chapter, two chapters of the book right there. So I can't wait to read about all the different traditions that we have and where they came from. All right. Well, signing off once again, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you guys. I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Have a good night.
Bye.